Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Asad, one of the co-hosts of the channel and your host for our conversation today. Our guest today is Simon Wolfgang Fuchs, and we'll be talking about his latest book, In a Pure Muslim Land, Shiaism Between Pakistan and the Middle East. Simon is a lecturer in Islamic and Middle East Studies at the University of Freiburg in Germany. His interests and work primarily center around how the Islamic scholarly tradition is debated and negotiated in modern Muslim societies with a focus on the Middle East, Central, and South Asia. Specifically, he looks at religious authority, sectarianism, the Islamic schools of law, Islamic political thought, and the relationship of Islam and science. The transnational nature of his work has led him to conduct fieldwork research in Egypt, Pakistan, India, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. Prior to joining Freiburg in October 2017, he was a research fellow in Islamic studies at Gonville and Caius College at the University of Cambridge. He completed his PhD in September 2015 at Princeton University under the supervision of Professor Muhammad Qasim Zaman, with a dissertation entitled Relocating the Centers of Shi'i Islam, Religious Authority, Reform, and the Limits of the Transnational in Colonial India and Pakistan. His latest book, which is the subject of our discussion today, is an extension of that thesis, and it is entitled In a Pure Muslim Land, Shiaism Between Pakistan and the Middle East, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2019. I will read a brief blurb on the back of the book for our listeners. Centering Pakistan in a story of transnational Islam stretching from South Asia to the Middle East, Simon Wolfgang Fuchs offers the first in-depth ethnographic history of the intellectual production of Shi'is and their religious competitors in this land of the pure. The notion of Pakistan as the pinnacle of modern global Muslim aspiration forms a crucial component of this story. It has empowered Shi'is, who form about 20% of the country's population, to advance alternative conceptions of the religious hierarchy while claiming the support of towering grand ayatollahs in Iran and Iraq. Fuchs shows how popular Pakistani preachers and scholars have boldly tapped into the esoteric potential of Shiaism, occupying a creative and at times disruptive role as brokers, translators, and self-confident pioneers of contemporary Islamic thought. They have indigenized the Iranian revolution and formulated their own ideas for fulfilling the original promise of Pakistan. Challenging typical views of Pakistan as a mere Shi'i backwater, Fuchs argues that its complex religious landscape represents how a local South Asian Islam may open up space for new intellectual contributions to global Islam. So without further ado, I now welcome Simon to our podcast. Welcome, Simon. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Asad, for having me. It's really a great honor to be able to talk about the book, and I'm really excited about the session that we will be having today.
Of course. So Simon, as I'm sure you know, we like to start these interviews at the New Books Network always with a brief biological account of our guests for our listeners. Now, you have a stellar, and if I can say so myself, quite an enviable CV. Of the four major Islamicate languages, i.e. Arabic, Persian, Urdu, and Turkish, you're proficient in the first three. You're a native speaker of none, and you've done research in libraries across various countries and several regions. You've met with high-ranking scholars in the Islamic tradition, and I presume your journey of exploring Islamic intellectual history is still ongoing. So on the topic of intellectual history, tell us a little bit about your own intellectual history. What brought you here? What inspired you? And why Shiaism between Pakistan and the Middle East?
Yeah, sure. I mean, thanks so much for this question. It's really interesting. When I started out to do Islamic studies in a German context, we were very much focused on the Middle East. So I started out with Arabic and later then I also did Persian, studying in Iran and earlier in Syria. And I really had originally no interest whatsoever in South Asia. It's really nothing that you encountered during your studies. I wasn't really encouraged, you know, to study this other region. It was really seen as marginal and not particularly interesting. And I remember before really coming to Princeton and embarking on this project in general, I read Mohammad Qasim Zaman's book shortly after, I think it was published in 2002, on the ulama in contemporary Islam, Custodians of Change. And I remember that I enjoyed reading it, but I felt, well, you know, if he had only focused more on the really important ulama in the Middle East, so why all this stuff on Deobandis and these South Asian guys whom no one really knows, and why should I really care about all of them, and what's the point? And then it took a couple of years until I saw the light. You know, when I originally applied to Princeton, I was also interested in a completely different project. So I suggested that I wanted to work on the reception of Ibn Taymiyyah during these centuries when he wasn't such a big and influential scholar, so basically before the end of the 19th century. But, you know, then life intervenes, and I encountered my supervisor, Qasim Zaman, who's just not only a wonderful scholar, but also an extremely gifted teacher. And then, you know, this was one component that suddenly South Asia came in. And then I thought, you know, this was also my own ignorance before starting the PhD, that I thought I would be really interested in Islamic law. But after taking a course for an entire semester where we did the nuts and bolts of Islamic law, which are mainly, you know, discussing sales contracts and urf and customary law and this sort of stuff, then I realized, well, maybe at the end of the day, I'm really more interested in theology. And then, of course, the Shi context is to a certain extent even more interesting than the, you know, so let's say the Sunni approach to theology, since they have to grapple with many more questions. So how do you defend Tawheed and monotheism if you really also have these imams there who are really influential and semi-divine or superhuman figures? And how do you reconcile all of this? And so this requires much more intellectual labor, I think, also to defend a stringent monotheism. And this was the other, I would say, appeal, you know, Shi Islam had to me in particular. And then this all came together after I did some research and realized that, you know, we know a lot about Shi's in Lebanon, or recently there has been a lot of work done on Shi's in Iraq. And of course, Iran has always been of interest. But the Shi community in Pakistan, even though it's the second largest worldwide, had been largely neglected. And the studies that existed focused on very specific issues. But there was a lot of room still to explore and to discover. And I became extremely excited and was not disappointed,
well,
I would
thank
say.
Thank you for that. And so I guess in addition to Arabic and Persian, you had to pick up a third language to access Pakistan, which is...
That's right. So this happened and also at Princeton. So that's, I think, also the beauty of the PhD system in the US, that you're really given time to reinvent yourself and to devote time to new languages. And yeah, in my case, this was Urdu. At this time, Urdu wasn't even offered at Princeton, since we don't really had this focus on South Asia. And also, you know, I was attached to the Department of Near Eastern Studies, where you'd also think that South Asia doesn't really feature in the focus of such a department. But then I started actually doing some Hindi in at Princeton, and then the real Urdu learning really happened when I was in Pakistan. And at this time in 2011, when I got to the country the first time, there was no official program or that catered to foreigners due to the security situation. So it was all much more informal. But I think, you know, as you, I'm not telling you any secrets, if you start out with Arabic and Persian, then Urdu, and especially Urdu that deals with religious ideas and text, is not, the distance is not too far to also obtain another language.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I think you touch upon a very important point about disciplinary boundaries, which we're going to go over further in this discussion. So let's move on to the book. You know, there's a lot going on here, and I'd like to work through it chronologically. So you begin your study in the late colonial period, shortly before the independence in 1947, and on the cusp of the partition of the subcontinent into what became known as India and what became known as spot split between West Pakistan and East Pakistan. One thing that really stood out to me were the rigorous debates that took place within and between Shi'i figures prior to the state's founding about what their place would be in this new Islamic country, or quote-unquote Islamic state, so to say. The Muslim League was now ready and steady to found this new country, and many of the Shi'i ulama, as well as the intellectuals, were worried because it was predominantly Sunni, even though in practice they were all secular. You do several things in this chapter. You map out the internal tensions between the Shi'i clerics and Western-educated Shi'i intellectuals. You discuss how Shi'i scholars position themselves vis-a-vis Sunni ones, while also offering a novel approach to sectarianism. You make a great intervention with regards to the sectarian debates that took place and the conflicts that took place, especially in Lucknow. And you lay the groundwork for exploring the international dimensions of Shi'i thought during the last decades of British rule. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit more about your findings during this critical foundational period before we go into post 47.
Sure. No, I'm happy to do so. So I guess, of course, I was really inspired also for this period of time by the great work of my friend and colleague, Justin Jones, at the University of Oxford, who has really published an excellent work on Shi'i Islam in colonial India. And even though I agree with many of Justin's findings, so there were some issues that I took, or some aspects that I took issue with, for example, when he makes the case that Lucknow really emerges as this unassailable dominating center of Shi'i Islam in the subcontinent, where Shi'i scholars are also working or rethinking Shi'i Islam in a way that it becomes its somewhat freestanding and its own religion independent of Sunni Islam. Because first of all, I think it's not only Lucknow, where things are happening. Also the Punjab emerges as an interesting Shi'i center in its own right at the time. But then also I feel it doesn't really do justice to, what you just mentioned, also this internal diversity and especially this conflict between traditionally educated ulama and also a modernist streak that we not only see in Sunni Islam emerging, but also in the Shi'i context. And for me, in particularly helpful were the proceedings of the All India Shia Conference. This was also meant, to unite the Shi'i community, drawing in modernists, modern professionals, bureaucrats, but then also these mujtahids. But over time, in the 1910s, 1920s, this organization really redefines itself. Basically, the mujtahids of Lucknow get kicked out, and then modernist voices take over who are extremely critical of these ulama, who don't really know what the Shi'i community needs at the time. And we see extremely harsh criticism also of the mujtahids being out of touch with the needs of the Shi'i community. So that's one development that I found quite striking. But then the other one is also that I don't see it so much as Shi'i Islam in this time emerging as its own freestanding religion, but it's more really an effort to redefine Shi'i Islam as original Islam and to claim it, not really to establish something that runs in parallel with the majority's Sunni Islam, but really as claiming that if Sunnis were only would only see the light or would only think clearly about the major tenets of their faith, then they would also realize, or they should come to the conclusion, that Shi'i Islam offers a much more convincing interpretation of early Islamic history, of questions of how to relate to God, of how transcendent conception of God should be, and all these sorts of questions. And this was definitely also another aspect that I found quite striking. And it once again reminds us also when we talk about this late colonial period and communalism and, the questions of conflicts between Hindus and Muslims, it makes also a lot of sense to look at the internal conflicts within all these communities. Not only the Muslim community is extremely diverse, but then also it's not sufficient to narrow this down to a conflict then between Sunnis and Shi'is, but also within Shi'i Islam, there's a huge controversy about, you know, how to reconcile religion with modernity going on as well. So tying all of this together, this is basically what I was trying to do in the first chapter of the book.
It's really interesting how, with regards to the internal conflict within Shiism, there's a debate between, you know, whom you describe as the reformists versus the traditionalists. And the nature of the debates that took place between these two groups, legitimacy is claimed with regards to how distinct they were from their Sunni opponents, or the traditionalists, rephrase, the traditionalists would attempt to delegitimate the reformists by pointing their proximity to Sunniism. And to me, it just fascinated me with regards to the ways in which we think about how Islam was contested right before independence, right at the cusp. And even at that critical stage, there was no agreement with regards to what direction Islam should take. Forget that. Even within Shiism and Shi'i groups, there was no agreement.
Right. No, totally. I would, this is, I guess, what also was really surprising to me. And I think there's also much more room to identify additional figures or other scholars that we haven't really looked at. So especially this time period, the late colonial period, was really striking for me when you go to the British Library, for example, and you have, of course, these documents on Sunni-Shi tensions in Lucknow in the 1930s. And these files are extremely well-worn. You know, people have looked at them several times. Scholars have written about these conflicts, the so-called Tabara agitation in the 1930s in Lucknow. But then if you would consider or consult what they label as vernacular tracts in the British Library, often if you consult this material, then the pages have to be cut open, you know, because no one has really looked at this material. And a lot of polemical stuff, but also really interesting interpretations of Islamic history. So I would encourage everyone really that there is still work to be done. There's so much left. Yeah. And I, of course, could only scratch the surface it's quite natural with a project like that.
You've done so much, more than enough, honestly, I want to really move on now with regards to one of the key interventions you make in your book, which really stood out to me, is the interrogation of the notion that Pakistan was or is a Shi'i backwater. So you show in your book how in the 60s and 70s that there were rigorous intellectual debates taking place among the intellectual elite within the country. And you also argue that, quote, the vocal acknowledgement of transnational authority in general and the embrace of the seemingly rigid system of emulation in particular does by no means render local agency obsolete, end quote. And you do so by examining the indigenous and internal South Asian intellectual debates on taqlid, i.e. emulation, through exploring Pakistani Shi'i journals like Al-Hujjat and Payam-e-Amal, which you assembled from libraries in Lahore and in Sargodha, as well as from the personal libraries of Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi in Qom and Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim in Najaf. So could you tell us a little bit about what conclusions you came to after examining these debates and going through these journals with regards to how the intellectuals and the ulama in Pakistan in the 60s and 70s embraced transnational authority without compromising their own local agency?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm more than happy to do so. So I think originally I started out with two very diverging opinions on, you know, how Shi'i Islam in Pakistan would relate to the wider Shi'i world. And there are people, especially anthropologists, who would make the case, you know, these transnational actors, these grand ayatollahs, the sources of emulation sitting in Qom or Najaf, don't really matter to Shi'is in Pakistan. So they are much more interested in local forms of religious, processions and mourning rituals and this sort of stuff. And there are other people who would really make the case that since South Asia is so peripheral, only the mujtahids in the centers of Shi'i learning really matter. And when going through all of this material, several things stood out for me that to a certain extent in the 20th century, we really see this paradigm shift as far as religious authority in a Shi'i context is concerned. The grand ayatollahs become much more approachable. You can contact them. You know, of course, nowadays it's even easier, but also then in the 1960s and earlier, you could approach them via, you know, telegrams, or you could travel much more easily. And Pakistani scholars would, of course, also go and study for long periods of time in the shrine city. So there was intensive interconnectedness, and the grand ayatollahs in the centers would send representatives to Pakistan to collect religious taxes on their behalf, but also to support schools, to hand out scholarships, really being involved on the ground, traveling, you know, setting up programs to translate material into Urdu. So there was this this intense interaction. But at the same time, what I found particularly interesting is that some scholars really made a case of emphasizing the overarching authority of these scholars, but also setting themselves up as being the sole arbitrators or of this influence, that they would claim in every age only one supreme overarching mujtahid exists in the centers, and then basically he forms a hierarchy from which everyone is dependent, and they would set themselves up as the only representative of this particular person, for example, in the context of Pakistan, and being really close to the center, but in being at the same time indispensable for local Shi'is on the ground, who had no right to organize or to form alternative forms of religious authority, of communal authority. So this is definitely one aspect that I see. So by at the same time claiming this closeness and the overarching importance of one particular scholar, you set yourself up as really someone who is in charge for Pakistan, who is delegated to, you know, run sort of the show in a Pakistani setting. But what happens then if you establish such a close connection is also that we see particular periods of time. For example, you mentioned Mohsen al-Hakim, and he was a very crucial and overarching figure. When he then died in 1970, afterwards, there was really a period of uncertainty in a Pakistani context, or also worldwide, where it wasn't really clear who would become his successor on a worldwide stage, who would take over the mantle of being the next really big source of emulation. And at this time, local scholars use this time period of uncertainty, and suddenly they would no longer simply transmit legal opinions formulated by Mohsen al-Hakim in Najaf, but they would start answering requests for fatwas themselves, for example. So this is one particularly interesting development. And then I think another aspect that we see is that, and this refers back to this paradigm shift that I wanted to mention earlier, as far as the authority of Najaf and Qom is concerned, that also, I think the internal debate in Pakistan shifts between especially traditionalists and more, you know, traditionalists, esoteric-minded scholars and reformists, because even traditionalist scholars who would emphasize the esoteric potentials of Shi'i Islam and would claim that we could have a direct contact to the imams, we don't really need this scholarly hierarchy, this established hierarchy developed during the time of occultation after the disappearance of the 12th imam, you know, which sees this system of being of muqallids and these sources of emulation, but we could have direct contacts with the imam. So even if we focus on this, we still have to make arguments for a rejection of this hierarchy by referring to the leading scholars in the center. So it's really not a source of authority or not shift in the debate that even these traditionalists can ignore. So they also have to make the case basically that if you read the tradition, if you read the leading scholars in the centers, you know, carefully, then you will understand that they don't subscribe to any reformist positions. So they would not, require Shi'is in Pakistan to change their rituals, to streamline them more with other forms of Islam, to make it more acceptable to Sunnis to abandon bloody mourning rituals. But precisely all of this is really condoned from the center, since it's an expression of the essence of Shi'i Islam. And so everyone is trying to, I wouldn't say instrumentalize, but really use this transnational authority of scholars who are far away and who also usually don't write in Urdu and are not involved in these debates to claim that we can speak on their behalf. and in order to make particular interventions in the local Pakistani scene. So also what's happening as far as language is concerned, you know, the texts are translated from Arabic and Persian into Urdu, then becomes extremely fascinating and interesting in this regard.
Yeah, it's interesting the ways in which, you know, this phenomenon is both hierarchical and non-hierarchical. Hierarchical in the sense that there's still something to which that they're referring to, but non-hierarchical in the sense that the centers are merely references. They are not the drivers. The local actors themselves are driving. And is it safe to say that they are the driving force of their ideas, but they are referring to the centers for legitimation?
I think this sums it up perfectly, better than I could have done. I think, Asa, that's precisely what I was, I think, with my long-winded answer, what
Long-winded answer was great. So speaking of the centers, I want to move on now to one of the most watershed events in, you know, modern Middle Eastern Islamic world history. In the 20th century, and that's the Iranian Revolution and its reception in Pakistan specifically. So in the 1979 revolution, as I'm sure our listeners know, is one of the most significant historical events of the century. We can even call it a rupture from the supposed teleology of history for being the first modern revolution to bring into power the institution of clerics. You know, your chapter on the revolution and on Khomeini specifically and his ideas and the ways in which they spread, explore how they were received in Pakistan. And you divide the reception, of Khomeini's ideas into three stages, essentially. I'll just outline them briefly and then maybe we can talk about them. So in the first stage, you say, the initial months and years after the downfall of the Shah, which you periodized between 1979 and 1984, when the revolution constituted, quote-unquote, background noise to the internal conflicts taking place between Pakistan's own Shi'i community and the state. And it's here like they were the Pakistani intellectuals and ulama were still trying to figure out what was really happening in Iran. They weren't really aware, but they couldn't divert their attention completely away from it either, given that it was a neighboring state, it was one of the major centers of Shiism itself, and it did have implications on them. So the second stage you describe is the rise of one Sayyid Arif Hussein al-Husseini, a prominent cleric who drew from and appropriated and repackaged the revolution for the Pakistani context to close ranks among the country's Shi'is. In a way, he seemed to have localized or indigenized the revolution for Pakistan. And then the last stage you describe is a full-fledged embrace of the revolution, specifically in the city of Lahore, the cultural capital of the country, including the embrace of Khomeini's controversial Vilayat-e-Faqih doctrine, the guardianship of the jurisprudent, led by one Sayyid Javad Naqvi. So I was wondering if you could briefly describe what each of these stages entailed for Pakistani Shiaism, how it transformed Pakistani Shi'i thought. And for me, I'd really like to, would it be right to say that among the Pakistani Shi'i intellectuals and ulama, that there was a spectrum with regards to the reception of Khomeini's ideas that went from, on the one end, rejection, then in the center, reappropriation, and then to the other end, replication. So three R's I came up with. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I wouldn't go so far as to say that anyone actually rejected what was happening in Iran. You know, even I think this would be rather tricky to do, since Khomeini and Iran is extremely or was extremely popular in a Pakistani context. But I think reappropriation was definitely happening. And then your third R was replication, right? Yeah. So I think these two are both much stronger, and we can explain these three stages that I was trying to identify by the fact that in the early 1980s, Pakistani Shi'is were really in this very tricky position that they had a military dictator to contend with in Pakistan, Zia-ul-Haq, who had come to power in 1977. And I think the leadership at this time was really extremely careful not to be seen as just working on the behalf of Iran, because this would have completely delegitimized their demands that they had towards the Pakistani state. So they were really trying to keep Iran at an arm's length and to acknowledge that the revolution had existed and to praise it in some terms, but really not to be seen as, you know, working hand in hand with Iran or really taking either, you know, intellectual input or money from all of this. But I think even, you know, also crucial for this time period is really what you have already touched upon, this lack of connection that really existed, because basically this is also the case until today, that many of the leading scholars who were in charge of the major seminaries in Pakistan at this time had received their education in Najaf. So they were also not really familiar so much or had not so much an interest also in the context of Iran. And it's interesting that they also made sense of the revolution in very South Asian terms at this time. So I also quote in the book a couple of examples where Khomeini appears somewhat as a, or in some way like a superior Muslim Gandhi who focuses on non-cooperation and non-violence. So this is the way how he brings forward or, you know, fosters the revolution. And then also how that he is conceptualized in certain terms that are very much rooted in South Asian, also Sunni Islam, and not so much in a Shi context. And in the 1980s or in the course of the 1980s, this changes somewhat when, as you said, Sayyid Arif Hussein al-Husseini takes over, since he also spent a couple of years in Iran, had a close personal interaction with Khomeini, and I think he's still a crucial figure, we could say, for the Shi community in Pakistan. For me, this was also quite striking when I spent really my first longer period of time in Pakistan in 2011. I got to Islamabad for the first time, and I had in mind the Shis were this oppressed minority in Pakistan who were basically invisible. And then you come to the capital and suddenly you see pictures of Sayyid Arif Hussein al-Husseini on every lamppost in Islamabad, since this was close to the commemoration date of his assassination in 1988. And he was extremely visible in the heart of the city. So I think this also tells you something about the visibility and the importance of Shi Islam in a Pakistani context. And he also was under intense pressure. He was often asked to what extent the Iranian revolution could be replicated in Pakistan and what this all should mean, the Iranian system of government, the guardianship of the cleric, to what extent he would also be interested in implementing this in a Pakistani setting. And he would always reject any of these suggestions by claiming, you know, Iran was only an inspiration as far as the economy was concerned and these sorts of things to have a more just economic system, but there was no interest in revolution, and they wanted to work within the framework of the current Islamic State. And so I think it's really only a younger generation of scholars who have been entirely educated in Iran for a long period of time who are nowadays willing to embrace the revolution and also scolding Iran, and they would also scold Iran for not really doing enough in bringing about revolutionary change in Pakistan. And for them, the Lebanese Hezbollah has emerged really as a model that shows the way how, even in a minority situation, you could try to impose your will on a political system.
Well, that's a great transition into the next question that I wanted to ask, and it relates to your fifth chapter in the book, which you title Longing for the State. And here you make a very important intervention with regards to how we understand sectarianism in South Asia and arguably the Middle East as well. I like that you draw attention to the important work done by Osama Makdisi in Lebanon, where he demonstrates how sectarianism, as we understand it today, is a quintessentially modern phenomenon, quote-unquote, intimately tied to the emergence of the nation-state. But I also like that you draw from another scholar, Faisal Devji, who problematizes the approach to sectarianism that focuses entirely on material interests to the exclusion of ideas. And I think that's crucial, especially given how much of today's scholarship tends to gloss over the significance of texts and ideas. And this, of course, continues to be a sensitive discussion both in our post-Edward Said Academy as well as in public discourse. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit with us about your methodological approach to the texts and to these ideas, and your findings concerning sectarianism with reference to actors in Pakistan after the Iranian Revolution.
Sure. No, I mean, you're right that Faisal Devchi's work has been extremely influential for me also in shaping the ways how I would think about sectarianism in Pakistan, because he really makes this crucial intervention also to emphasize the importance of Pakistan as this contested political idea, and that we see a struggle over what Pakistan should mean as a homeland for Muslims in South Asia since its inception, that it had always been contested and an unfinished project to a certain extent. And I think in this context of really still not being completely worked out, the Iranian Revolution came in and offered a rival political project, you know, like a very interesting fusion of you could say theocratic and republican elements that would that could really also be a model how to construct an Islamic state. And Pakistan was still struggling with all of these ideas, and suddenly you had the revolution emerging next door. And in my view, as I approached the texts from the time period from the 1970s, 1980s, what I would say is happening is that the political really takes center stage in these sectarian debates, because what people have often pointed out, the importance of Saudi Arabia in fostering sectarian violence and animosity in a Pakistani context, they would point out in particular that there were certain figures from, we could say, Salafi angle, from the South Asian Ahli Hadith tradition, who were educated in Saudi Arabia at the Islamic University in Medina, that was founded in the 1960s, and then came back to Pakistan. And this was sort of seen as the model of how of Saudi involvement and how the story goes as far as sectarianism spread. But when you look at the writings of these figures in the 1960s, 1970s, these are mostly really Salafi arguments about Shia Islam. So doctrinal issues are at the forefront, that the Shiis would believe in the corruption of the Quranic texts, that they have despicable views on the imams, that they are guilty of polytheism and these sorts of things. So classic anti-Shi arguments that are then repackaged and made quite prominent and available to a wider audience. But there's not really any discussion of Shi's being a political problem. And this changes in the 1980s after the Iranian Revolution, when also different groups take over the mantle of anti-Shi sectarianism. These are no longer indigenous Salafi groups, but these are Deobandi scholars who precisely focus on the political aspects of Shi Islam and how Shi's are a problem because they would undermine with their criticism of, for example, of the companions of the Prophet. You know, this is no longer simply an issue of aqidah, of creed, but it's really a way for them to undermine support among Sunni populations for the caliphate, which Pakistan ultimately should aspire to become. And then we really see very much a shift as far as emphasis and the complete flavor of these sectarian discourses is concerned. And in order to appreciate this, as you also pointed out in your comment, I think it's really important also to take sectarian polemic seriously, so that we can also appreciate what's happening and how things are shifting. And of course, I'm not saying, you know, that this is the silver bullet that explains everything. And of course, there are also material concerns, and all of this is involved as well. And I'm sure local conflicts play a particular role. But the overarching picture, I think I'm able to modify with my approach, that this is not just a conspiracy that is hatched abroad, and there was sectarian harmony in a Pakistani setting, and then suddenly these discourses get imported. But it's very much a Pakistani story that just becomes exacerbated by these external events, and sort of explode after the occurrence of the Iranian Revolution.
Yeah, Simon, your book is clearly a phenomenal intervention in several ways. You know, you've cut across Middle East studies, South Asia studies, Islamic studies, You put forth a new understanding of sectarianism. You argue for a more complex interaction between the internal dynamics of Shi'i Muslims as well as the external dynamics between South Asia and the Middle East. You give more agency to the actors in South Asia, and you argue for a new paradigm. That calls for paying attention to the bidirectional flow of ideas between South Asia and the Middle East rather than a unidirectional one. So based on your conclusion, this is for our listeners and for myself and for anyone else who's interested in doing transnational or transregional history, how can scholars and students draw from your lessons towards a more transnational and perhaps even a global understanding of modern and contemporary Islam? What needs to be done?
That's of course really an excellent question, and to a certain extent, I think I'm also trying to do this in my next project, to overcome some of these boundaries that we have as far as area studies are concerned, that we are maybe also limited often in the way we use sources. That we only pay attention to sources in one language, that we think important debates take place only in Arabic, for example, or for Shi'is only in Persian, and then we neglect to see how often scholars navigate different layers or different languages at the same time. And I think this was especially interesting for me to have some of these figures in a Pakistani context who are very much tied to the the centers of Shi'i learning in Iraq and Iran, and are familiar with discourses emerging from there and are fluent in Arabic and Persian, write in these languages, but at the same time also develop an Urdu personality which is not so much accessible to the centers, where they can develop their own agency. And really, I'm not saying that they are disingenuous in doing so, but they just emphasize different aspects to a local audience in a Pakistani context. So I think just to flesh out how they navigate these different settings and environments is, I think, crucial. And this happens in many more contexts than I'm sure than I'm able to show in this book, and I'm sure there's much more room to explore such dynamics. And in general, I think also the question of reception and reworking of certain aspects, not so that even maybe a faithful acknowledgement of authority elsewhere doesn't preclude you from carving out your own niches and really important aspects of authority. So I think not to be satisfied with simply pointing out influence, and also in this present day and age when the Middle East and the entire region is really so much seen through the lens of geopolitics, where we see the influence of Iran and Saudi Arabia everywhere, of Qatar and Kuwait. So to also, I think, question really the influence these actors have, and to emphasize the agency of local actors. And I think a lot of this opens up, the door to many very interesting new stories. And I would also, encourage to use different sources, travelogues, periodicals are really fascinating as a source for this time period, where we can also overcome some of these issues, especially when we study religious scholars who are often extremely polite in their more elaborate academic writings. They wouldn't name names, they would be reluctant to call out their enemies, so to speak, or to engage in anything that has to do with controversy. But there are different types of sources where you can get much closer to the personality of people, and also to flesh out what this really means for them. So I think that's another aspect that I would really encourage colleagues to take a look at.
Well, that was very well said, Simon. It's a lot to chew on, and I'm really going to look forward to, being able to really marinate over all of what you just said. And I think to conclude our discussion with one final question before we close off, and as a teaser for our listeners, would you be able to share a little bit about what current projects you're working on and what work of yours we can look forward to reading in the near or distant future?
Yeah, I hope it won't be a too distant future for you to wait for until this project finally arrives. But at the moment, I'm really involved with a global history of the Iranian Revolution. And this is a project that stems out of really my interest or my findings in a Pakistani setting. And in particular, I would like to focus not so much on the Shi'i world and how this event has been reworked and received in these contexts, even though this will also play some role, but I'm much more interested for this current project to recover this moment of 1979 and the early 1980s, when also many Sunni Islamist groups in Tunisia, in Lebanon, in Turkey, in Pakistan, India, obviously, but also leftist groups in all of these countries as well, were highly fascinated by the events taking place in Iran, and they were really intrigued and were asking themselves many questions. This led them to reconceptualize how they would approach politics, how they would use political vocabulary, how they would, for example, rediscover the social question that had been so important in an Iranian context. So many of these things, and then also drawing together material from South Asia and the Middle East, is also proves to be extremely fruitful, since at this time, you know, I've been going over Islamist journals from this time, and you see the same texts also really traveling from Pakistan and being picked up by an Islamist newspaper in Kuwait, then it's published in Tunisia, then it reappears in Lebanon, and all of these debates are really connected, but at the same time also really localized, and trying to tie all of this together is what I will be doing over the next couple of years.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating and interesting project. I'm really excited to be able to have an opportunity to read that. And I really want to thank you, Simon, for being on the show today with us. I enjoyed our discussion, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you, Asad, and thank you for all your very precise and very stimulating questions, and it was really a pleasure, and I look forward to all further reactions also to the book, and thanks so much for giving me this opportunity today.